Is it Ms. Keller?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning to you and Mr. Lewis. Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Then Ms. Keller, you may approach and you may proceed.
Can I reserve 2 minutes? We'll see if we can get to it. May it please the court, my name is Becca Keller. I am an assistant public defender in Douglas County. I am here today representing John Vaughn. I have a couple initial matters. First, I was his trial counsel, so I was present for all pretrial matters involved in this case. Secondly, I think it's important that I start my time by clarifying the factual record. I think there was some confusion in the briefing as to the sequence of events. In this case, we have an DEA agent from the Iowa Police Department boarding a train as part of a DEA task force at 5:40 a.m. on February 4th, 2021. He is a trained officer who is patrolling the train looking for suspicious activity, or as he referred to it, what is consistent and what is inconsistent. He notices a duffel bag on a luggage rack. That duffel bag is placed properly. It's not in the hallway, not obtruding anybody. It's where bags are supposed to go when you're on the train. He can't see a luggage tag on it, so he approaches it and sticks his face right up to the zipper seam and smells the bag.
Are you contending he cannot do that?
Well, I think it's an interesting question because there's clear law that a canine sniff of luggage is not a search because it's inobtrusive. But we also hold canines to a much higher standard in their ability to smell narcotics than we do an officer. In this case, this officer had a canine in his vehicle that he did not utilize. His canine receives certification every year and spends 16 hours renewing that certification. That information was all adduced at the suppression hearing.
It's a lot of interesting facts, but my question is, was he allowed to do it?
I think likely he was allowed to smell the bag, as long as he didn't touch it. Now, we have separate case law that says that you cannot manipulate the luggage in order to get an odor from the bag, right? The evidence in this case is he didn't touch it at all. He just got his face close to the zipper seam. I think that probably is fairly similar to a canine sniff in that it is not a search because it is inobtrusive.
You can cross-examine the officer and you can't cross-examine the dog.
That's true. That does make it a little bit more useful for us if it is an officer. Now the question is whether an officer's detection, an officer sniff as I've called it, of this luggage constitute probable cause in the way that a canine sniff does. Again, we're talking about a highly trained animal
haven't
who is certified every year.
Haven't we talked about that issue with the plain smell? An officer approaches a vehicle and smells marijuana, and haven't we said that gives the probable cause to search the vehicle?
We have, as it relates
to... How is this different?
This is not a vehicle case.
This is a train.
This is a train.
A train, not a vehicle?
A train is not a vehicle under our current case law. In fact...
Under Nebraska case law or under case law generally?
I don't know that Nebraska has addressed it at all, but I can tell you that the United States Supreme Court has addressed it. In California v. Acevedo, they specifically addressed the United States versus Place case from the 80s and said that Place is inapposite to vehicle search exception to the warrant requirement.
It wasn't that. Wasn't Place luggage inside of a airport or a terminal? It wasn't actually on the plane or on the train?
Yes and no. Officers approached an individual who had luggage, asked to search it, but because he was in short time to get to his plane, decided not to.
When so he was standing in line to get on.
Correct. That luggage went on the plane, made it from Miami to LaGuardia, And when he got off the plane in LaGuardia, they again asked to search.
Is this a little bit more in line with the bus station cases?
I would agree with that. Now, the difference in my reading of the bus station cases, again, we don't, most of those involve some kind of manipulation of the luggage or removal of it from the train because, or bus, because in a situation like a bus or a train, your luggage is stored often separately from the passenger itself. So
aren't you arguing the officer should have gotten a warrant?
Yes.
So what happens if the officer gets a warrant?
Then
he leaves to go get the warrant, and doesn't the train go on to Chicago?
It does.
And isn't that the very same exigent circumstance that why the automobile exception exists?
I don't believe so. Now, United States versus Place says that if you have probable cause of contraband in personal property in a container, in combination with exigent circumstances, you may seize that property and request a warrant. That's what Place says.
So that's what you're contending should have been done. He should have taken it off the train, requested a warrant.
Yes.
And let the person
if the concern is that
belong just continue on their journey.
There's a couple ways to resolve that. You give someone an opportunity to take ownership or possession of that bag, and they can stay with their bag, or set up a way to retrieve it, assuming no contraband is located after a search, right? There's another, or no one fesses up to it once the bag, and it's considered abandoned. And that's a whole separate issue for warrantless searches of property. What we're talking about is personal property, and the United States Supreme Court has been clear that that has increased protections above a vehicle, that people have more right and expectation of privacy in their personal property.
And we also said if you have probable cause to search a vehicle because you smell marijuana, you have the probable cause to search any containers within that vehicle?
Containers that are within the reach of the
passenger vehicle.
Right.
So
this is not that.
Why is it not that?
Because there is no basis for the officer to search, there's no probable cause exception to the warrant requirement for personal property.
Is the grabbable thesis in part based on a risk of danger?
That's also true. It has there's a distinction in the case law as well for luggage that would be sitting in the back seat next to a passenger in a vehicle versus luggage in the trunk of a vehicle. That's
not grabbable isn't relevant to the automobile exception.
It isn't. It's related to the search of the personal property, which is different than a search of a vehicle. It has different requirements and different expectations of privacy. That's my argument.
Did Mr. Vaughn deny that the bag was his?
At trial, he testified that he told the officer that it was not his bag.
Aren't there cases that hold that if you deny that the property is yours, you don't have standing to object to its search?
The information at the motion to suppress hearing is that Officer Miller testified that Mr. Vaughn told him the black bag belonged to him. So at the time that the motion to suppress went before the trial court, the information before that court was that there was an admission of possession.
And Mr. Vaughn's subsequent denial that he owns the bag doesn't waive that on appeal? He says it's not his. Why does he care if it was searched?
This court reviews the motion to suppress based on the evidence that's provided at the motion to suppress hearing. That was preserved during trial. I don't know that by preserving Mr. Vaughn's request to suppress this evidence, that preserving that is entirely undone by his later testimony.
Could you back up a little bit in reviewing the denial of a motion to suppress after conviction and on appeal, the scope of the record? Is it only the arguments that to suppress, or is it the record as a whole?
It's the record as a whole.
Thank you.
Before your time expires, did you want to talk about the Amtrak employee? Statement and whether it's hearsay or confrontation clause or things of that nature?
I would love to. The testimony that we're referring to is that Officer Miller went up to an Amtrak employee who is not named in reports who said that the bag belonged to the person in sleeper car 12. And that was the basis for Officer Miller's next step in his investigation to identify who owned this piece of luggage that he suspected contained marijuana after he searched it. Now, that statement is a hearsay statement because it is offered to prove the truth, which is the owner or possessor of the marijuana. Now, the state argued at trial that it was offered for the state of mind of the officer to explain how his investigation proceeded. But I would note for the court that if the out-of-court statement implicates an accused, there is prejudice, actual prejudice to that defendant that overrides the potential for non-hearsay purposes. That we're talking about the only basis at that point in his investigation that he had any reason to contact Mr. Vaughn is based on this individual who is not named, who was not brought to court, who we were not allowed to cross-examine, who pointed him out of an entire passenger train as the owner of this bag. That's the only connection that this officer had to connect my client, Mr. Vaughn, with the duffel bag with suspected marijuana. And that is extremely prejudicial.
And the court found it, determined it wasn't hearsay, and therefore allowed it in, but gave some type of limiting instruction.
He did.
Was that sufficient?
I don't think that you can cure that hearsay statement, that prejudicial statement, based or with a curative instruction. Now, there's case law in Nebraska that says even fleeting comments that are non-responsive to questioning about a defendant's criminal history or time in prison in front of a jury cannot be cured by an admonishment. And this is more than that, is my argument, is that more than biasing a jury to someone's history or past with otherwise irrelevant or inadmissible evidence, we're talking about a person who we have no idea who they are, being able to establish an element of each of these offenses without being able to question him or her or cross-examine them or address in any way how they had this information.
If we were to agree with the district judge, if it was hearsay, it was not hearsay, is there still a confrontation issue?
Yes.
Why?
Same reasons I just said. We have no way of knowing, because we were not permitted to cross-examine this person, where this information came from, whether they picked a random train car or not. This information directly identifies Mr. Vaughn as the accused, and we have a confrontation right to ask them where that information came from, to address what their information is.
The information went to a specific element, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. Good morning again.
Good morning. May it please the court, Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. It's Mr. Vaughn's direct appeal of his conviction of possession with intent to distribute, failure to affix a tax stamp. Mr. Vaughn assigned several errors. Getting into the motion to suppress issue, and the admitted evidence that resulted, there were sort of two assignments of error that resulted from that. The odor of marijuana is sufficient standing alone to furnish probable cause for a search. Police can constitutionally stop and briefly detain a person for investigative purposes if the police have reasonable suspicion, supported by articulable facts, that criminal activity exists, even if probable cause is lacking under the Fourth Amendment. Again, that plain smell exception can establish probable cause. At the suppression hearing, the state established through Deputy Miller's testimony that he is a trained and experienced law enforcement officer assigned to a DEA task force. that they entered the Amtrak train for drug interdiction investigative purposes, that this was an investigation that was fairly routine. I think that there's testimony that they were doing it every day. The DEA task force members were looking for indications of suspicious travel as part of this routine investigation, including untagged luggage. Deputy Miller saw a duffel bag on a luggage rack in a sleeper car without a baggage tag. He testified that he smelled the seam of the bag and recognized the smell of marijuana coming from the bag. He then went to the car attendant, the Amtrak employee, and asked if that person knew who the owner of the duffel bag was. That person indicated that the person in room 12 was the person that she believed owned the bag. The officer then went to room 12, which was located directly across from where the bag was located, knocked on the door. Mr. Vaughn answered, indicated that he was the owner of the bag, and then the officer asked a couple of questions about his travel plans, and the rest followed. Subsequent searches, more marijuana found in bags within his cabin, and some other products, I think, like you know, cannabinoid wax or things like that. Once furnished with probable cause for the search via the smell of the marijuana in the bag, as the state's contention, the officers had at least reasonable suspicion, but more likely probable cause to approach Vaughn and speak with him.
You're not contending that there's a general, probable cause generally allows you to search without a warrant. There has to be some exception to the warrant requirement, correct?
Yes, yes.
Which exception are you relying on?
The exigency of the circumstances, given the fact that this is a train car, it has a scheduled arrival time, it has a scheduled departure time, the train was bound to leave at some point. I think that there is testimony about the time that it arrives and about how long it sits at station. There's also some body cam footage that shows the officers going through the train. It's a fairly long train, and it shows just sort of the scope and nature of trying to check all these bags. There is no indication about at what point in the search they are, but even if they're at somewhere towards the beginning, and even more so if they're at, you know, sort of the last of their train cars, the potential that the train is going to leave sometime soon is, I believe, you know, presents exigent circumstances that, you know, the train and whatever additional evidence might be upon it might sort of, you know, fly the coop and be several miles, if not several hours down the track before it would be able to get picked up again.
Mr. Vaughn contends that the officer should have seized the bag, taken it off the train, obtained a warrant, then to search the bag. Why shouldn't the officer have to do that?
Well, I don't believe that the officer should have to do that. I suppose that they could do that if they wanted to do that. I don't think that the law requires, and I don't think that there's any case law that seems to indicate that we have in Nebraska that indicates that they should have done that. Certainly they could have, but I just think given the facts and the circumstances, they were under no obligation to do that given, again, what they had in their hands, what they knew at the time.
In fact, the bag was on the train. The train was scheduled to leave at
right.
A 10 to 15 minute stop.
Exactly, yes.
Is there anything that prevented one officer from staying on the train with the bag and one of the other officers who was on the task force from doing the legwork necessary to get the warrant?
No, there's certainly no testimony to that effect, and I'm not, you know, aware of how, you know, sort of these interstate, federal, quasi-federal, you know, local task force, you know, operations work. I don't know if that is, you know, part of their best practices or something that they do on a regular basis. I mean, I suppose that, you know, anything is possible. I don't know. There's no testimony as to whether or not that is something that they do. There's no testimony about where their next stop is, whether it's, you know, clear through to Des Moines or they've got stops to do in between or something like that. There's just nothing on the record to seem to suggest that that was something that they would do. Instead, it seems that this is, and again, this is me talking, you know, based on the evidence, it seems more like their standard protocol, you know, given the fact that this is a routine investigation, that they just sort of pull everything off the train and let it sail, including the person involved.
Is this best addressed by sort of analyzing these specific factual details or better analyze saying the same reasons that broadly allow officers to search everything within an automobile also apply to a train?
I would say that probably more the latter than the former. I mean, clearly a train presents a little bit different sort of factual circumstances. The positioning of the luggage, the fact that admittedly, they had to knock on a door and wake Mr. Vaughn up. I believe the testimony is that he was asleep. It's a little bit different than approaching a driver's side door with a driver who is hopefully alert and awake when it gets stopped. But I think that given the case law that we have, the application of some of these principles beyond just a car, I think that the broader, you know, analysis that's afforded by the automobile exception works in this case. It's the state's contention that this is a pretty standard first-tier investigation that moves rapidly into a third-tier encounter after Vaughn confirms that it is his bag.
The court didn't suppress that statement. Is that correct?
No, they did not.
Was that error?
I don't believe so. There's testimony that from Officer Miller, and there's some body cam footage, but there's no body cam footage of that actual officer conducting this, exchange with Mr. Vaughn. But there's testimony from Mr. Miller that he was standing not directly in front of the door, but somewhat adjacent to it, and that the questions that Mr. Vaughn answers that are, yes, that is my bag, come pretty quickly in the exchange. There is no, am I free to leave? You know, you are free to leave at any point. There's none of that exchange. There are admissions and acknowledgments by the court, and I think pretty much everybody involved. We're talking about pretty tight quarters, both in the corridor, the little roomette that he has, ticketed for himself. It's all pretty tight, but I don't think that the admission of that statement is a problem. And then also, you get into the follow-on problem of the fact that he then denies that it is his bag and denies that he had anything to do with it, and essentially that officers planted both that bag and maybe even this other bag in his roomette that is later found with him on him. So taking all that stuff together, I think it's not a problem.
Given his testimony that the bag is not his, does he have standing to make the arguments he's making on appeal?
Certainly at the suppression hearing, once we get into the looking at the overall record for purposes of appellate review, I am not entirely sure. I don't necessarily think so, if that is his contention at trial, and we're supposed to be, taking these things all, together all at once. I'm not exactly sure how to square those things, because they are sort of fundamentally opposed to each other.
What about the Amtrak employee's comment about room 12?
Well,
is that hearsay?
Excuse me?
Is that hearsay?
I don't think so. I don't think it's definitional hearsay. Hearsay is a statement other than one made by the defendant while testifying at trial or hearing offered to prove the matter, the truth of the matter asserted. Now, a court statement is not hearsay if the proponent offers it for a purpose other than proving the truth of the matter asserted. And then also, statements offered to show their effect on the listener are not hearsay. To the extent that they're offered for context, coherence of other admissible statements, and not, again, for the truth of the matter asserted. This was not a, put into context that I think that the officer is trying to show how he got from point A to point B, rather than smelled bag with marijuana on it, just opened up a door, and there was a person there admitting that that was their bag. I think within the context of the trial and trying to show how the investigation furthered, it gets the officer from one step to another, point one, point two. The Amtrak employee does not say, that is Mr. Vaughn's bag. He is over in, whatever room. I saw him carry it onto the train, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is more along the lines of, there's a man in room 12. I think that's his bag. And that's really all there is to it. And then again, it's complicated by the fact that, assumedly, a couple of minutes later, you've got Mr. Vaughn saying, yes, that's my bag. So I just don't think that falls within the definitions of hearsay as provided by both the case law and statute. And then also, the dovetail onto that is the mistrial, the requested mistrial is premised upon a finding that that is a hearsay statement. And again, the state just doesn't believe that it is.
Does the confrontation clause apply if we were determined it was not hearsay?
I wouldn't think so, no. If there are no further questions, I would just submit on the rest of the state's brief and the rest of the issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
That then concludes arguments in State versus Vaughn and concludes arguments for the day. Counsel, you are excused, and the court is adjourned.